This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I know you're out there. Hi. I guess I'm kind of the warm-up act tonight, but I'm Patrick Lannan, for those of you who don't know, and from the Lannan Foundation. Before I thank a few people, I just wanted to briefly give you a little history. This year, 2010, is the 25th year the Lannan Foundation has been a public charity. This is the 18th year we've done a readings and conversation series. We started in Los Angeles, and 18 years ago in that season, which was the 91-92 season, Jimmy Baca read on February 11th, 2002. So he's back tonight, so it's kind of full circle. We've been talking about that. And we started here in 98, and this is our ninth year at the Lensic. And I want to say that we wouldn't keep doing this year after year if it wasn't for the audiences that and the interest in the series. And so on behalf of all the people in the Lensic who make this, all the mechanics happen, all the volunteers, Bob Martin, of course, and everybody here, and all of us at the Lannan Foundation, I want to thank Santa Fe and the Santa Fe audiences. You're great. You're great, and we'll keep doing it as long as we can. I also want to just thank one person especially who's here tonight. There's actually four directors of the Lannan Foundation here for the beginning of the series, but there's one director here who happens to be my sister, and she's from Evanston. She's from Chicago, and she lives in Wilmette. And all these things that I've just mentioned, all the history of the Lannan Foundation, wouldn't have happened except that she, in solidarity with me, was willing to wage a fight at the beginning of our history that made it all possible. And I want to ask her to stand up and acknowledge. Where is she? I know I'm embarrassing her, but Sharon? I can't see her. Is she? There she is. She's a great sister and a great friend, and it's been a great 25 years. I hope there's a few more anyway. Now, Carolyn Forché, you all know about her, I think. She's one of the great American poets. She's a distinguished professor of English at Georgetown and also the director of the Lannan Center for Poetics and Social Justice, I want to say, but social action. Anyway, here's Carolyn. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. It's an honor to introduce Jimmy Santiago Baca this evening and to have the chance to speak with him on this stage where so many compelling conversations have taken place throughout the history of Lannan readings in this auditorium. I wish to thank Patrick Lannan and Lannan Foundation for all they have done for literary culture in this community and throughout the world, and for bringing the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca. Thank you. And for bringing the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca back to his birthplace, Santa Fe, for this reading tonight. For years, I have gathered the work of poets who have endured conditions of extremity, poets who suffered especially the brutalities of imprisonment, and who survived to write out of the spiritual and physical wounds inflicted upon them by this experience. Such poets include Nazım Hikmet of Turkey, who spent half his adult life in prison, and whose writing is so suffused with its deprivations and agonies that even when he was writing about the late spring thaw of ice on the water jug, his reader would know that this was a prison poem written by a hand confined. Such poets as Hikmet wrote from all countries during the brutal 20th and 21st centuries. Jimmy Santiago Baca is their brother. He joins Hikmet, Paul Celan, Joseph Brodsky, Alexander Watt, Otto René Castillo, and a host of others whose language has passed through the horrors of their experience so as to be indelibly marked. If the historian, the late historian Howard Zinn, gave us the true history of our country, the people's history, then Jimmy Santiago Baca gives us its secret, present, and yes, dangerous reality. That at the heart of our democracy, more people are imprisoned in the United States than anywhere else in the world. We have created an archipelago of industrial human warehouses whose brutalities include beatings and the torture of solitary confinement, which Jimmy Santiago Baca endured, as well as state-sanctioned and inflicted murder. We are in the universe of the carceral imagination now, and far, we are told, from where poetry most flourishes. Yet the poet who will read for us tonight not only wrote his first poems from the depths of solitary, but first managed, with the help of a few books and a precious dictionary, to assemble the puzzle of literacy for himself, so as to write his way towards survival. His prose and poetry do more than give voice to his indomitable spirit. They take us on a perilous journey through the bowels of our country. And they also hold up a mirror, the kind convicts hold through the bars of their cells to see who is coming down the tier. It is a mirror held up to America, and one hopes it is not held up in vain or held too late. Jimmy Santiago Baca is an Indio Chicano poet of this land, who has also written some of the most lyrically beautiful images I have encountered concerning the sacredness of our surroundings here. Listen to the music of his work. Wings of bees wedge board bin cracks, sticky with chili mash, and flies gorge in tin pails and buzz in paper sacks. And this one about felling a tree. Where the tree had stood, a silver waterfall of sky now poured down. Still air, red dusk. I felt I had just killed an old man. As compellingly as he writes of imprisonment, he writes of childhood, his own and his children's. Of his people, Chicanos, Native Americans, farmers and laborers, and of the land, these mountains, their rivers, birds, and animals. In many of these poems, I hear Walt Whitman's spirit and also Pablo Neruda, Jimmy Santiago Baca's poetic mentor. Here is that spirit singing of America in Baca's voice. It is all well, husky, barrel-chested cities of America, drowning in your liquor and gambling and clothes, your rebels and libraries, your blood vessels filled and gorged as if dams broke loose and hurtled toward gutters and gulches. None can stop you. All rush to their boats made of bone and sails made of red cloth from the heart. And you sail America, waving to others, all passing, passing and floating by. So in all your grand wonder and greatness, I wonder, who am I here? This is the question he asks America on all of our behalfs. Jimmy Santiago Baca, who wrote his way from a childhood of abandonment, orphanages and detention centers, a young manhood of confinement, who saw in literature a river that might bear him away, who became a poet, a memoirist, an essayist, a filmmaker, and most recently a novelist, this month celebrates an important anniversary with us. After spending 25 years variously imprisoned, he spent 25 years a free man. And this marks the month when he has been for a longer time a free man than confined. He is a man free in many senses of the word, but most importantly free in the word that gives strength and hope to others. Please join me in welcoming Jimmy Santiago Baca. Go, boy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John. Thank you. That was really wonderful. Thank you, Carolyn. She's not only a great introducer of poets, she's an extraordinary poet in her own right. In fact, one of the poets, when I was studying poetry in prison and stuff, one of the poets that most influenced me was her book that she wrote from Guatemala. It was extraordinary. It reaffirmed that I could write sometimes, maybe write like her. And she was the first woman that reaffirmed my spirit when she did an anthology for Norton, and she went around the world picking out poets. And the anthologies, usually, when people pick out poets, they pick out academic poets or poets that don't have a rap sheet. Well, Carolyn was so extraordinary and so ahead of her time that when she did that anthology for Norton, she happened to pick out some of the greatest poets in the world, and almost 80% of them, I think, were in prison. From Mandela to the Turkish poets to the African poets to all of them. And it was so cool to be given that legitimization and given that credibility as a poet, because everybody always says, oh, but he's a criminal. And Carolyn was one of the first poets in this country to say he's a poet who happens to be in prison. So thank you for that. The other thing I'd like to do is welcome my wife, Stacy. She's here. And my my daughter Lucia and Gabe and Isai. Yeah. And since they drove here from Albuquerque and their bedtime's at 7, I'm going to open up with a story that we read in bed stories all the time. And so here's the story that Isai loves the most. He keeps telling me, read that one about the eye. And so I'm going to read you the story now so your mom doesn't have to read it to you when you get home. Okay, guys? That way you can go straight to sleep if I can. It's called The Magic Marble. This was when we were moved from a boarding house in Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Indian School. They moved us from that boarding house across the street, and it was very scary. And some of these kids that are extraordinary poets up here with Andy's group, they'll understand what I'm kind of reading here. It's called The Magic Marble. Isai, listen up, and Lucia, this is your bedtime story. When it was announced that a marble tournament was to be held and that the champion would go on to the regionals, and if he advanced, then on to the state finals, my friends and I sat in the ditch away from the other orphanage kids, and we dreamed ourselves the champions. We crushed dry leaves and rolled them in old comic book papers into cigarettes and smoked them. We were big guys even at 7. A month or so from being adults, it was either Peanut Head or Big Noodle who came up with a plan on how to achieve our dream to be champs. In short, we figured Cavallo's glass eye would do it for us. That is, we simply had to direct it into the ring and it would knock the marbles out of the circle. We thought the glass eye could see marbles and so would never miss. We would not only win, we would make history and the Guinness Book of World Records for the most marbles ever hit without a miss. But how to get the eye from Cavallo? Kavala was a medieval dragon of a man. There were four brand new dorms recently built, 100s for the toddlers and infants, the 200s for the slightly older, 300s and 400s for the older guys. My friends and I were in the 300s, and Kavala also slept in his dorm. He got up earlier than us kids, trudged like one of Solzhenitsyn's Russian peasant prisoners in the semi-dark to the subterranean boiler room and stoked the fires to get the radiators knocking to warm the classrooms before school. Sometimes I would pass the boiler room and catch a glimpse of him below, and shivers would run down my spine. A grisly org with Popeye forearms, hair stiff and bristly as barbed wire, a permanent scowl of hatred on his face, and a perennial stream of yellowish mucus dripping from the glass eye socket. The last time he glowered when he glanced at me, it scared me enough that I made it a point to avoid passing the boiler room for months. Every night, Kavala took his glass eye out and placed it in a glass of water on his bedstand next to the cot. With his eye out, he looked fierce. The eyelids of his socket shrunk back into tight whorls of flesh seamed with mucus. But we did have to get that eye, and the marble tournament was drawing near. We decided that we would wait until he went to sleep and crawl over to his bed and pluck the glass eye from the water. He could always get another glass eye, and we would win the tournament, and as they say, all's well that ends well. The kids in the dorms finally went to bed, and the nun who had her own enclosed room in a corner of the dorm said goodnight and turned off the lights. We waited a good hour until we could hear kids snoring, farting, and moaning. Big Noodle and Cuckoo Clock crept over to my bunk. Soon, Peanut had arrived, and they all took their stations as planned. Cuckoo Clock was posted by Sister Juanita's room and ready to alert us if he heard her moving about. Big Noodle and Peanut Head stationed themselves at the head of the bunk rows and lookouts. I crawled over to Cavallo's cot, dipped my fingers into the glass, scooped out the magic glass eye. I turned, and I saw a blurred object sailing past me and attributed the blue, dark object to my own imagination. As everyone knows, your sight plays tricks on you in the dark. Anyway, it wasn't my imagination. It was a boot that someone had hurled through the air, and it hit Kavala in the head. He rose from his sleep and rose out of the bed in a mean roar, growling for his eye. Sister Juanita awoke and came out and turned on the dorm light, and I froze as Kavala loomed over me like a mythic one-eyed giant from a Greek story. He bent down and his face came within inches of me as he yelled, "Where's my eye?" And just before the lights had gone on, I had managed, as much as I was repulsed by it, to put the eye in my mouth. I had no choice. I intended to spit it out later, but it didn't work out that way. Kavala yelled and scared me so much that I swallowed it. Sister Juanita pulled me by the ear into the bathroom for the next hour. She made me swallow salt water after salt water after salt water and puke and puke and puke until the marble came rolling out onto the bathroom floor. So much for the marble tournament. As punishment, we had to wash all 500 windows in the buildings, and we missed the tournament. I still wonder from time to time, who in the hell threw that boot? I've learned since then that as you grow up to be an adult and enter the world, a lot of people throw boots in the dark. Every time you plan a plan out, it boom. This is my Gabriel. Wherever my son Gabriel is, he was part of the beginning of. I so want to thank the Lannan Foundation for making not just this possible, for supporting poetry. They're extraordinary, and I honor them. Gabriel was part of that whole beginning in Los Angeles. He was about this high, and now he's 24 years old. This is a birth poem to him. And I've written both poems, birth poems, to Isai and Lucia. So this is Gabe's, and this comes from one of the earlier books. It's called Child of the Sun. Gabriel's birth, sun prayer. Beatrice on the bed, muscles twitch with pain. No, the pain. And then Marcia offers a wet towel. No, no. And then Beatrice paces the bedroom across the corn planting blanket, barefoot through the rows of corn dancers, caressing the abdomen, deep breathing, lips expelling flurries of frenzied pain while her fingers circle her belly button, trying to ease the torture. And in a tub of water, Beatrice rises and says, no! And she pulls my hand into hers, and we stand in the bathroom, window sunlight at her back, silhouettes her body to a shadow that smolders sunlight off of it. She radiates light streams. Her face grimaces intense pain and pleasure. Her head lolls forward. Her long black hair veils my face. And as I kneel before her on the bathroom floor, I say, get your leg up on the toilet seat. That's it. Now push, push. And through the vines of hair between her spread legs, where blinding light streams through, our dark bodies create a cave dwelling, enter through the hair, and she mutters grunted pleas, aggressive squeals, grips my shoulders, breath pants at my head, and her body drips sweat as sunlight radiates through the roses and the vines that press against the window at her back and rages between her legs as she gives a half-choked sob and upside down, suspended between her legs, surfacing from the sunlight and the leaves and the flowers. Andale! Here comes thousand-year-old face Gabriel! Gabriel! A flying dark shape in the sunlight, a god descending from the sky, upside down between woman's legs, Mijito Gabriel, arms and face glistening darkly with uterine juice, shimmery, it wriggles free of mother skin, fierce, glum, godhead, stone face that I stare at through the vines, stark eyes squinch-lidded, and wrinkle in haunting ferocity at me. And instantly I'm tossed out of my body into a wheel of light, disembodied in a blaze of dazzling light waves. I see myself being hurled like a spark from the chimney flue on an updraft of his gaze. And then Gabriel slips from her trembling loins, fill me with juice. Rivulets of blood run down my hands and wrists, and he cries angrily at me as I brush through the vines, and I rise in the sunlight haze misting the bathroom, and I offer Gabriel, child of the sun. I look at the window. I bow to the sunlight for my child's safe arrival. That was to my son, Gabe, and I haven't read that one in ages. Now, this one here is, this one's to a friend of mine named James Drake, who's a great artist from here. And, this one is, well, let me see here. This one is, some poems that were attending James Drake's photographs. And he asked me if I would write for him some of these. It's about some men. He tracked them to La Brisa Cantina in Juarez. And they were men who came to the border, and they became transvestites and work in a bar. And they began to smoke crack. A lot of them got killed. A lot of them died and stuff. But it was a duality of them becoming, of men from the interior of Mexico, having to find work on the frontera and become women. So it's that duality that he asked me to explore. So I explored this duality, okay? This is the duality I explored as a Chicano, half Indian, half European. I won't read all of it. I'll just read some of it. And this is in their voice. It's called Smoking Mirrors. I come out of the south, from the darkness where death ferments at dawn, seeping from limbs, moistening what is hard and cold and alone at night. I come from the south, out of the darkness like a dream, a storm beneath my flesh, two faces, two bodies, a hybrid flower of honey and poison, half moon, half sun, intoxicated on fragrance, stinking of sweat, smooth and rough, bearded and hairless with penis and vagina, 2 mouths constantly quarreling, 2 tongues, 20 fingers and 20 toes in constant conflict, 2 of us, blurred at birth by some cruel god, always alone, out of the dark, like an extinct animal, my body a cave I look out from at night. See my red eyes, my sharp teeth, my red heart bleeding. I can easily kill a surrender to you. Kiss or bite, smile or snarl, because I'm made of two, opposite and similar, a field of flowers and cactus. And in a strange way, I give and I take life. Yes, what you would call this whore, this slut, this freak of nature, this hideous beast, gives and takes life. You're so fickle, so easily manipulated. You're a mere feather that I sway in my hands on hot days. I'm a snake sloughing skins. I'm a friend of the dark, slithering in the low-life streets, arching with fangs that fill you with sweet venom as you gasp for breath, as you aching vow all your love for me until you discover I am you. And something in you dies. You turn into a destroyer, maiming and murdering my kind. And I withdraw beneath your beatings, beneath your raging fists and feet. Your macho revenge spills onto me with your secrets and loves and whispered sins. I cradle in my bleeding mouth, my toothless jaw. I cherish in the embrace of my broken ribs. But I destroy your ideas. Your view of the world I crush. Of the way things should be, at night in my world, blue becomes black, red becomes yellow, man is woman. Light and dark blur, the moon is the sun, the night is the day when I come out. I let go of the rope, you fall into the entrails of my life. With my gentle, caressing hands, I crush your view of life. You do not understand how much pain I'm in. Memories of myself as a boy, confused by being born different than other boys, always hiding behind the cemetery gravestone. Shame gutted me, created in me a dark hole that each day I died in. While other children's lives were played in parks, I headed and crouched behind those headstones in the cemetery and wept my shame. While other boys watched TV on couches, I was drawn to dance on the broken alley crates for lecherous men and women who seduced me. I survived my two-sexed disease, deceiving friends and drug fiends, lying in bed with an innocent lover. My sheets become vile plumage where I gorge on his love with vultured hunger, ecstatic pilgrim whose shrine is the male body, male sighing after coming, male gripping my ass, male pounding me from behind, male kisses, rough and horrible and filled with pain. Oh, the pain, the pleasure of men's passions as they pillage and open me and adore me and honor me and devour me in their hatred and their love. And then the dream's over. And seeing my face stubble, studying with contempt my manly features in the mirror as if from a grave, I wake to the dawn. Yearning for the night again. When I'll sing sweetly to charm men's lewd attention and lure the cobra from the basket. Not the reflection in the mirror will they see, not me plucking my eyebrows nor the wrinkles on my male face, but opening my compact mascara case, pulling out my eyeliner and tweezers. The mirror will begin to open again like a dark curtain for the actress, and I'll transform into the young girl. My lemony breasts evoke dizzying delight. Yes, obsessed with my flesh and my lust and my body. The curved wings of my thighs and hips and legs float across their hearts like wassail birds, filled with voodoo sexual fulfillment. Thrones and furs is what I desire. Down-filled beds and comforters, popular sought after, that even flamenco guitarists wail their lust. Walking under peach trees through the flowered gardens of Chiapas,
I forget the back seat cars as a sweaty whore, turning tricks for Americans for $20. I open my legs to the moon, rings on each of my fingers. Call me your witch as I kiss you and strip my clothes off. Make this night for me, please. For you, please. As if we were both falling, falling into a world with happiness. And not us, as we are, looking for love. For a man to love me, to love me, to love me. That was part of the poem. Here's one. I'm not going to read the... I was into a real narrative stage at one point in time. I'll read you some of the sections of this. This is about... I wanted to know... A kid was telling me one day when I asked him, how did you quit doing so many drugs and become a good family person? And he said that he did quit when his daughter was born. So I decided to write a poem, and I went through the different ages of his life. I'll take you through some of those ages. Not all of them, but some of them. This is when he's in his early teens. Nobody cares what I'll find to eat or where I'll sleep. Under streetlights throwing dirt clods at hornets' nests. Unafraid of being stung, I vow to avenge my poverty. To gash unmercifully with a bicycle chain, spineless attorneys taking advantage of my misery. Rob executives in limousines sampling heroin or coke off a hooker's thigh and mug pretty brokers with golden smiles whose gutter glares condemn me because all the chumps who never cracked a soup line biscuit or had a court gavel crush their life should know I plan violent schemes against you. I pray saints melt my pain red hot. I'll hammer sharp to take you down, down to the darkness where I live and impale your heads one day on La Virgen de Guadalupe's moonsickle. Because I'm 12 years old and I am no good. Dime bagging Peruvian flakes, inhaling a glue rag under the bridge. With all your police and all your prison sentences, you can't chase me from the street or stop me from selling my drugs because in my square white piece of paper lives God. Ideal God. Who gives reprieve from this earthly hell and makes me feel good, if only for a second, gives me hope and self-esteem and transform this horrible despair to a momentary cocaine heaven until I'm killed or OD'd or like other homeboys trashed on a stack of county jail corpses who understood that life was nothing but a damn sewer grate. Dignity poured down with discarded city letter where crack creates light when all you ever got is darkness. So you see, crack is God. When hopeless days bury me under the rock piles of despair, blocking me from feeling anymore, breaking my heart into big pieces of nothing. Breaking my heart into pieces that say nothing. I am no good and preach nothing door to door. A strong kid full of nothing. From nothing do I ask a blessing and to nothing do I pray and I hope nothing forgives my wrongs and nothing helps when I come to take vengeance. And at 14 years old beneath the moon above the sportscaster's booth at the outdoor boxing coliseum, after crowds go home and the rings removed, I shadow box invisible opponents and I raise my hand as a champion to the moon. I join the homeboys against the rival gang and I skip down the bleachers over the handrails out of breath and I hold court in the field with a bat, a pipe, a chain, a knuckle, a gun, and a game where every kid has to hold a 5-ace winning heart or die with a poker player's bluffing hand. Because we all know, we were all born with the knowledge that death ain't nothing but an 8-ball on the break. And at 16, I'm a brown fighting get-down impromptu warrior. T-shirt rolled to the bare midriff, pomade hair back, low hip and hugs, inked across the right hand, bandana top button tied to the Pendleton, lean and mean haunting you with gangster signs from the street corner. And I learned my history. Never went to school. I learned it around a water bucket. Listening to mule tongue growers mutter holy wise, they had to barb off the lands. Clacking my hole in the grower's dirt on skulls and bones of my people murdered and buried in chains. And under a branding hot noon, I cut lettuce for the bronc-buckled soft-palm gland owners, posing as frontiersmen. Their steer-horn Cadillac radios tuned to the religious broadcast, bearing glory to the godliness as they loom over me. God hates you, Spick. You understand me, Spick? God hates you. You dirt, boy, you dirt. And even this here dirt grows some. But you dirt that ain't got nothing but weeds. And beat purple at age 9. Wood paddle whizzing like butt bullet stings. I touched the washcloth to the welted bruises on my thighs and legs, and I winced under the shower, and I was cursing my damn life. My heart the severed head of an outlaw pickled in a jar of liquor just to numb the hurt, purging the shame for being born, or OD'd, stabbed and shot, just wanting to believe I was bad because it was better than being dirt. It was better than falling into that darkness where nothing existed but darkness. And I wanted to exist, even as no good dirt. And at 19, trying to rebuild my life, I got the urge to get high and did. I put the pistol to my head and I played roulette. My bloodshot drunkard's eyes seething rage that my guardian angel didn't want me dead. And I got home that night. And the dirt yard pleaded for my daughter's laughter. I looked at her tricycle tread scribbled in the dust. You're always gone, Papa. And your whiskey and your outlaw friends and your drugs. You're never here to play or help me grow, Papa. There was no heat when I walked in. There was no light. There was no food. And I heard my babies crying way out in the dark corner of the house. And it was like a chisel on the headstone of my bones. Her need for a father wobbling to a stop when I went in. I picked her up from the crib and I inhaled her milky aroma. I started patting and I started kissing my baby girl, walking her back and forth in the cold living room, warming her in my heroin addict skin heat, breathing warmth on her, holding her and humming. Bendito, bendito, bendito sea Dios. Los ángeles cantan y daban a Dios. Los ángeles cantan y daban a Dios. And I just kept on humming, blessed, blessed, blessed is the Lord. The angels sing and give to the Lord. And then I saw her tiny hand flex like a wing, unwrinkling from the cocoon for flight. And I realized I'm two men. One loves her and cares for her, wants to live at home and be a family man and grow old with this woman. But the warrior bears its thorny teeth at domesticity and slurs in disgust at the dreamer's naivety and just wants to die unafraid in the streets. But tonight my infant is me and I am her. And I see myself as I was born, innocent and perfect my whole life ahead of me. And I can see that she can become me. Absolutely no good, not even as good as dirt. And I just hum, and I just hold her. I melt it into one hum until the dawn thaws frost on the window casements and to the stucco cracks and all the dogs croon and the ruts outside yelling cold from the jaws and tooth scratches, stickers from the paws. And I just keep on walking and walking and walking and walking. I can't have her be me. And then thinking how to give my family a better life, I go out and I stroll the South Valley ditch bank, surprised to see pebbles that last night's rain uncovered. There's some blues and greens and reds. And I just wish I could cry. I wish that my tears could reveal what's in me like that, the way the rain did that. And I throw a stone in the irrigation water as far as I can throw it. And I see where it hits the water and it gasps like my child's awestruck mouth, glistening for breath, for just a chance at life. Glimmering ripples calling, Papa, Papa, Papa. And I realize I got to start. Where the stone hits is the center that caused the ripple. Where the stone hit was the center that caused the action. Where the stone hit was the beginning. Where I am now is the center. And at 21 years old, I get down on my knees and I say, oh, lightning self, carved from throwaway woodpile days, please, Lord, carve a faith in me. Cut deep to the knot core of this man's heart and give me that limb-top buoyancy in the storm. Give it to me and let me hold on to the branch. Give me that awakening, that realization in the storm that I am a good man, that I am a good human being, healing the emotional earthquakes in myself.
Thank you. Here's a little something I'm going to read. This is a novel that came out, and it's from the woman's point of view who just got, she was murdered, and she was a singer, a Mexican woman. And this is her voice singing about what's most important to her. And I guess since I think that my wife and my kids are the most important people in my life, I did it in first person in her spirit. This is Nopal speaking from the spirit world. Thirst was on me my first step in the field. It churned in my stomach. It cried out in every muscle demanding water. You know, I sometimes hallucinated leaf dew, thousands of them, just gourds of water on the leaves. And my fingers and my shoulders and my neck lost their ache and in time seemed to get lost somewhere. It just seemed to float around and around the fields like a bird that had nothing to do as sweat dripped down my back and everything just seemed to loft up in the air when the illusions came. You couldn't hear anything. You couldn't taste anything. You couldn't see anything. You had no clue where you were. You were put in a place where no one else was. You were all alone and you were happy and pleased. And you finally thought you'd reached the paradise you've been waiting and working for all these days. Working all your life for this place and it just finally came to you in this field with flies and wasps and bugs itching at you. Here it came. Landing on your drenched t-shirt, shading your eyes for a moment. An eternal moment, whisking you off. Every nerve had a calmness you never experienced. You had never even realized that such peace existed because no one ever told you about it. No book or Bible preached a place like this that came to you when you were at your lowest and you couldn't take anymore and you couldn't believe in anything else. Them dewdrops on the leaves became gourds of water. And I knew it wasn't real. I just couldn't help but look and stare and lick my lips at the mirage fading into the shimmering heat waves. And I just keep on bending and picking as thirst nested under my tongue, becoming a dark hunger and that ground itself into my bones and gave no rest nor mercy. A thirst that made me believe I was the worst off woman in the world. That was that kind of thirst, that kind of despair that came over me and just never let me go no matter how hard I pulled against it. I became its prisoner. I belonged to it. It owned every part of me. And that was how I lived. I worked my life around it. I made my dreams around thirst. I decided on plans around thirst. I always kept it in front of my eyes and in my mind. I never once got up out of bed in that field camp, never once, and didn't have to think about thirst. I never once got up and looked out of that window and didn't think about thirst first. Nor did I look out over the horizon or at the sky and not think about thirst. And no matter how many glasses of water I gulped and gulped and gulped, it just kept wanting more. But when that man cut my throat, I never had a thirst so fierce. A thirst for life as mine was being drained in that alley behind the bar where I sang. I would have drank urine or vomit at that moment. My mouth contorting for just one more breath, one more drop of life as death inched and edged its way on me, shriveling in every pore and sucking at my soul, my raspy throat stinging like bees maddened by a poker, my tongue starting to swell up with death and my lungs starting to shrivel and suffocate. And through clenched teeth as I begged, just one more second, Lord, one, I quenched myself on memories of my two baby boys in the bar crawling on the floor under the tables. Me doing my sound check on the stage mic, gasping through my tears and blood, worried my boys might be sitting on the floor biting into some pebble as if it was candy or maybe catching some old ranch hand's hands under a woman's dress. Oh, my beautiful, beautiful husband waiting on me to return. I tell you, never a thirst so fierce as wanting one more second of life with my family. I'm going to read you. A lot of people ask me how I learned to read and write. This is kind of like how I'll just read you two small parts. I learned to read and write in prison, and it's not hard when your life depends upon it. If you gave me about 20 students and I said, by the end of the month, those of you that don't learn how to read, I'll kill. Every one of them students is going to learn how to read. All right. Okay, here's what happened. I was in a committee meeting, and I refused to work at the prison I was in. And I was in front of the committee meeting. Mad Dog Madrill glanced at the others in front of the committee. Anything else? Probationary period, 6 months, Bigfoot said, and wrote it down in my file. Mad Dog Madrill lowered his voice into the recorder for the closing comments. This committee cannot in good faith recommend school at the present time. Prisoners assigned field duty for 6 months. Requests for schooling will be considered at that point. He shut the recorder off. I was almost on the verge of begging them to reconsider. Feeling a great emptiness overwhelming, I raised my eyes to the counselor and I blurted out, but you promised me, man, you came by my cell, dude, and you stood in front of my cell telling me how great I was doing. And I felt my whole body swell with an explosion of rage. And he leaned forward and said, it's a fucking prison, asshole, and don't you forget it. You're here to be punished, you stupid spick. But the fights, I had to do what I did. You know what's going on. I was defending myself. Mad Dog Madrill snarled, 32-581, you're dismissed. And I couldn't move. I wanted to start the whole proceeding over and ask him, what'd I do wrong? I would have apologized. I would have admitted I was guilty of whatever they wanted me to be guilty of. But in each committee's member's face, there was only contempt. Despair and pain were mounting rapidly toward eruption, and I was afraid I was going to black out. I was trying to control myself, but my hands and legs had no feeling in them. An overwhelming sadness swept through me, an all-consuming sense of helplessness that ate through my face and hands and legs, burning me to nothing to the end of my life in this room, my whole soul aching and my heart hating them. Dismiss, Mad Dog commanded. And I don't know where it came from, but my sudden inability to move came on. It wasn't courage. It wasn't defiance. I just sat there until Mad Dog Madrill and 500 came around the table and grabbed me and stood me up. I can still see myself. I've gone over and over it. All I remember is hearing myself yell, I know what I was, but I'm trying to change. I'm just asking for a fucking chance. But the simple truth was, from the warden down to the guards, they had the power of life and death over me. And I truly thought they were going to keep me in prison forever. Now, this is where I refuse to go to work, and the guards come down after about a month. Later, when everyone had come in from work and was showering and getting ready for supper, 5 guards stormed through the front of the block into the landing with riot gear helmets, shields, and batons. In the lead was Mad Dog Madrill, and he yelled at the tear guard to rack my cell as the goons clomped up the shaking stairwell. Shake it down, Mad Dog seethed. He pushed me out on the tier in my boxers. Cons stuck their mirrors out through the bars, and I could see their confused faces and questioning eyes. And the goons ripped the mattress apart. They squeezed out the toothpaste tube. They emptied the tobacco bag. They searched myself for a shank. And all they found was a pack of sugar from the kitchen. Add contraband to the charges, Mad Dog commanded. 500 jabbed me with his stick, and he marched me down into the landing in the middle of the block. The cons stood at the bars as one voice, and another cursed in a deafening roar. They all shook the bars, yelping like hyenas, snarling over fresh kill, and their eyes were hard and glassy, and I tried to tell myself, they're cursing the guards. But it was me they were condemning. And I remember the humiliation of seeing them grip the bars and push their red, angry faces forward as they screamed at me that I was a bitch and a punk and an asshole. And they had revealed their secrets to me and they had believed that I had turned on them just because I wanted to go to school. But because they believed that I had turned on them, it made me no different from all the perpetrators who had raped them and killed their spirits. And I was the friend, though, that they had embraced and who had then stabbed them. That was one of the worst, one of the strangest days of my life. Their rage was forcing me to find out something about myself. I felt struggling to come out. Stripped of everything I believed in, the pride, friends, reputation for being a solid con, all everything was gone. I felt as if I was on the verge of discovering something, but I don't know what. I was facing the tears toward the cell when a cup of scalding water hit me in the shoulder from behind. And I turned, and someone else threw urine at me, and then someone else threw a styrofoam cup of feces. And it was as if I was standing outside of myself and watching this. This was not happening to me. I told myself it had nothing to do with me. I wiped my face with my hands. And the yelling caught on, and the whole block was cursing me from all sides now. And when I go back to that night, I think I felt at the time that I was insane. That it was only be a matter of time before I swirled into disintegration. And with wide eyes, I watched the ones who didn't scream at me with detached pity. They thought I was crazy, and if it happened to me, it could happen to anyone. Anyone could break.
A link in the chain had snapped, and for that, their repugnance stormed on me, shaking tears and trembling concrete, and I stood taking it all in, pretending to myself that someone else was standing there, not Jimmy. And Mad Dog Majul came down, chained me around the waist and hands and wrists, and he and the goons marched me out of the block toward isolation. Outside, going across the yard that night, I knew that, despite this loathing, by standing up for myself, I had done something completely new, and I didn't quite understand what I had done, but I'd done it. I might have lost the respect of my peers, but I was feeling some sort of weird sense of worth that I'd never felt before. And I knew I was no longer just a 21-year-old illiterate brown kid, not just another con who couldn't read or write with a number who was going to submit to the degradation. No, something had altered in me that moment. And I felt, for some crazy reason, a tremendous pride in having taken this one little step that I now knew I'd wanted to take for the longest, longest time. I'm going to end with these two small poems. To my beautiful children and my beautiful wife, wherever they went. Where you at? Isai? Oh, there you are. Well, where's your mama? Oh. We all understand that. Isai, here you go, honey. 12-1503. This is from a book coming out from Sherman Asher Press here in Santa Fe. I'm doing a box set with Jim Maffucher. And the reason I'm doing a box set is because Working in the Dark, Jim did it 25 years ago. And it's still in print. And so I'm doing these four books for Jim as a commemorative anniversary for our friendship and for the whole people of New Mexico, and especially Santa Fe. 12-1503. Isai collects dreams in the nest of his palm. Farmed sweet blackberry juice stains his hands and lips. Were he able to speak about the blackberries, Isai would simply say, God. He wakes from his afternoon siesta, flapping legs and hands, a bluebird perched on the birch branch of mother's arm, ready to raid cornfields in his father's heart. That's one. Number two. Here's another one. Isai, you're going to love this one. 12-1903. The day Saddam Hussein was captured, President Bush bestowed billion-dollar kickback contracts to CEO mobsters called bankers in the oil racket. That day, my woman was cutting my hair in the bathtub. I was standing up naked while you sat on the floor, Isai, gazing up at my penis, looking down at yours, making all kinds of guttural sounds. And after showering, we sat in your playroom, and I sat on the footstool, and I slapped my penis against my thigh. You laughed, growled, and I slapped my penis again and again until you fell backwards, laughing so hard, the whole time grunting at me more to make me whack my penis against my thigh. That's the kind of Americans we are. We're penis whackers, not warmongers. We had fresh carrot juice, a fruit plate, and coffee for breakfast. We sat in bed and sucked orange wedges, bit pineapple chunks, chewed apples, licked pears, sipped mango juice. The sunrise spreading over the three of us. In bed in New Mexico, nibbling fruit and kissing each other's fingers. That's the kind of Americans we are. Okay, here's the last one. 12-2503.
In the sunroom, my son cries out, happiness at sunlight strobe slanting through the big windows and spreading over his face. The sun has caught him in its bright net and weaves his laughter in its golden design. It's a game that he and the sun play each morning. Two infants playing tag in the schoolyard of life, chasing each other, rolling on the floor, climbing the walls. The sun acknowledges his existence and welcomes Esau each morning at the door, offering flowers and birds, green grass and warmth. How is it that the Census Bureau claims my son does not exist? How is it that racists say he's an illegal alien? How is it that society accuses this beautiful child of taking their jobs? How is it that police profile this beautiful, beautiful boy as a drug dealer? And since Chicanos have a high number of deaths in every war, generals believe Chicanos are suicidal. Nothing to live for except to sacrifice in war. And politicians look at me as a tireless gardener and housekeeper and someone to raise and feed children and wash dishes and sweep floors, seldom speak and scrub toilets. Esais are everywhere. In the streets, on every corner. Look out the window, you'll see 60 million Esais the government claims do not exist. And yet, know the time will come when Esai cannot tolerate the injustices anymore. And the newspapers and TVs and police and FBI will label him insurgent. Sunlight accompanying his every step.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Here we are.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful. A beautiful reading.
Wow. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I wanted to tell you that we have 200 students in the audience tonight. And yesterday you had a visit to the Santa Fe Indian School, and some of you are here too, right? Okay. Which was a very moving experience for you, as he recounted it to me. Your life experience is so harrowing, but also rich in rootedness to the land here and to the culture here. All of it comes through and all of it comes to life. And I'm sure that the students here can hear in your poems and in your prose and read in your poems and prose aspects of things they're going through too, and that their parents go through and their brothers and sisters and their friends and so on. So I think we may begin tonight by, I might ask you to say a few words to these students. And perhaps you want to tell about what happened yesterday.
Well, I went to Tim's class, and I have to first of all tell you that this gentleman, Tim, here in front, is a great teacher. He's an amazing. And I've been working, the students themselves are beyond praise. You like the sun in the morning, or you're like the tropics to the south, or you're like the ancestors to the west. You're like beautiful, and you're part of my life, and the work that you do is part of my life. The poetry that you did yesterday for me that you performed was part of my life. And it was amazing what you did. The origins, the mixed breed poem was extraordinary.
And then the conversation that we had in the classroom with Tim facilitating it. You don't know how happy my heart was to hear students like yourselves speaking and expressing yourself. Just bells from the cathedral. And not these ones here, but your own. Yeah, it was beautiful. Thank you.
I read your work as written out of a deep wound that's personal, of course, but also social, political, historical, and it's the wound of our continent, a wound inflicted by people who impose a feeling of inferiority upon other human beings, upon indigenous communities, and those who do not conform, as you have written, to Euro-American ideas. And your work gives, I think, is written out of that wound and gives voice to it. Can you talk about that? You have talked about it in your work from time to time. But it feels to me, both in the poetry and in the prose, and over time this has developed and intensified in terms of your work, that there's a kind of incising open. You're always cutting open within yourself as you're writing, cutting down deep to the very root of what has happened to you and writing out of that. Is it true? How do you feel it? Well,
you know, that's a great question. That's a wonderful question. Let me say that I've got some work I've been working on for years, and it's going to take a few more years to finish. But in America, I don't think we can cut out a slice of pie and focus on that slice of pie as a writer or a poet. I think some very good work is happening. There's so many things going on at the same time. The environment, stem cell research, immigration, education, all of it, and a thousand different manifestations that I'm trying to discover a language that originates from balancing on the border of two. You know, like I find myself often in the work that when I get a chance to do some work and stuff like that, I really try to see Caucasians and Chicanos, Mexicans, Chicanos, Indians, Native Americans, Caucasians, African Americans. Everything draws me back to this border language, this border source, where the language is different. Because I don't think we have the luxury or the privilege anymore of spouting our pious opinions. I think we all have to come to a compromise at the border somehow. We all have to come to that place and create a language. And I don't think I can't. I mean, I can. I can. Those borders, the borders of language, the borders of literature, the borders of history, the borders of education and stuff, I try to challenge them all, but in a way that if it is a wound, it's one that comes from exertion and pride of the individual. I don't mind getting a wound if it's in the process of me exerting myself in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. I just can't stand to get a wound and be a victim or be in a destructive mode of being. You know? I mean, if my back hurts from 20 hours of writing, I love it. If my back aches because I've been sitting at a bar stool in New York for 3 days drinking, I hate it. You know, what are the differences, you know? So the aches and pains and the wounds are all good as long as they come from a place where I've been exploring what the language of the borders is. We just don't have it anymore. We can't just say anymore, this has been oppressed and I'm owed something and this is where I come from. It's not going to do anymore. It just won't do. And you just can't stay in academia. You just can't stay there. You have to open up that door and come out into the community now. You cannot filter yourself with gated walls and communities anymore. You cannot do it. I think we're at a time right now that's crucial. And I think we have to create wounds in our comfort zones. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to.
You have, I think of you as a bridge person, the bridge person who can go back and forth, shuttle back and forth between one world and another, one community and another. But let's talk about the borders for a moment, especially the border, where they're now erecting this ugly, what they're calling a fence, between, right across the land that they call the border. And I'd like to talk about SB 1070 and about Operation Streamline and about everything that's happening in the United States officially and institutionally to separate us and to treat immigrants and people who come here to work, who come here as criminals, who criminalize them. Operation Streamline is unprecedented in our judicial history, wherein they take groups of people and have them all plead guilty at once for entering the United States illegally. And then they're arraigned and they're found guilty, and they then have a record which deprives them apparently of the right to ever come back. And so, I mean, talk about these things which sicken me. And you write about this. You write about it in Stories from the Edge in 11 Cents. And you address this issue throughout your poetry and your work. And I'd like you to talk about, where are you there now with that? I mean, how are you feeling right now about that and about, you know, writing through it?
I think if you combine the politics of Arizona and the screenplay of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I think, you know, I come in with my roster sheet and check the patients. Is the governor here? Yes, she's here. Did you get a medication? Is Joe Arpaio here? Did you lock him up in the cell? Yes, okay. Make sure you up the volume on that man. 1070, SB 1070. So many law enforcement officials are turning away from it. They're not even, 80% of them are saying we can't and we're not. And that's it. You know, there has to be this, look, there has to be in everyone's life in some way. SB 1070 is happening in everywhere, everybody's life. It's just, it may be an Arizona line on the surface, but if you walk down the Santa Fe streets, you see people every day that look at Mexicans and kind of like, they're taken, they're not, they shouldn't be here. It's everywhere. There's just no law here. There's no law in Oklahoma. There's no law in Texas and all these other places. But it exists. We have to scapegoat somebody somewhere, sometime, all the time. Somebody has to pay the price for the fact that we can't have two brand new trucks in the driveway, but just one. You know? And the whole idea of, you know, this is what I think is happening with writers and poets that I've read and I read a lot. I think that writers and poets are good ones. Coetzee, for one, South Africa, great writer. Love him. Love his work. Mm-hmm. Your work. I don't think that we're writing to gain acceptance or approval. I think a lot of writers are walking around with metaphysical black eyes. We all got black eyes from being popped. Because we're confronting people and powers and systems in a way that writing and poetry hasn't done in this country for a long, long time. Whitman did it, but stopped short of Manifest Destiny, you know. Mm. But a lot of writers and poets who are not writing politically used to write so that they could entertain the reader and gain the reader's acceptance subliminally or gut-wise. They would love this. But now the writer and the poet are not concerned about winning the approval of the reader. They're more concerned about slamming the truth on the page now. And I really like that. Yeah.
What do you say to people? And I see it repeatedly. It's on Huffington Post again this week. Poetry doesn't matter. Poetry's not important. No one reads poetry in the United States. Talk back to that.
Well, my daughter Lucia, wherever my beautiful wife went, with my daughter Lucia,
outside, I think.
Yeah, it matters to me because those young Native American women right here made me feel much stronger when I walked away from that school, because my daughter now has role models that are going before her. So thank you. It does matter. Where else can she find a role model like these women? Certainly not in the politics of Delaware. Or, God forbid, she ever see the likes of Sarah Palin walking across the street. Now, my daughter's going to follow these young women right up here.
Thank you. I found very moving your descriptions of sounding out letters and piecing together words and teaching yourself to read and then teaching yourself to write. And you even became vulnerable to the extent that you were willing to publish in your book the first letter that you wrote to the outside, to the man who became your correspondent for a while. But your work evolved over time in such an amazing way, from the early poems to the later poems, beautiful lyric passages, incredible facility with description, some of the most amazing images I've ever seen. And then your work changed. You had longer lines and then, you know, shorter rhythmic, quick sequences of incantations and invocations. It's astonishing to me how you made those leaps. Your process, your trajectory as an artist is fascinating. And your willingness to write prose and screenplays and everything. Can you talk about that, how that felt to you? I mean, from the earliest piecing of the letters to this facility now in this beautiful new novel that you've published.
You know, there's some amazing poets and writers that I absolutely love. I just adore, I mean, I just can't wait for their next book to come out, and I run to the bookstore and buy it. Most recently, the English major, Jim Harrison. I love that guy's work. And not only that, a lot of the poets that I read, I'm reading Denise Levertov's work again. I picked it up a few days ago. And they wrote, they kept their genre, and they maneuvered in those constraints of the genre. And it's an extraordinary genius to be able to maneuver within the constraints of a certain genre and just keep going with that. I'm more of a kid who gets bored pretty easy. So I write the long narrative poem like Martin in Meditations, and I was really, really exploring metaphor. And I did explore metaphor, and I found that the space between the two words create a third image that releases a sort of dormant energy that acts on you. It's an active agent that comes to you. And it enhances your sight, and it mobilizes your perspective to see something in a different way. And it's fantastic to be able to do that with language, to be able to incantate, to be able to call language to you and have language work on your mind in such a way where you physically are changed by it. So once that happens, it's like a really wonderful white heroin.
Jimmy.
It's a great bottle of whiskey or something. I don't know. All I can think about is a great high. It supersedes any drug. It supersedes any alcohol. It was the greatest high in the world when I realized I didn't even feel the change on me, right? So I was like, yeah, that's great. So now I don't want to do the exploration of imagery. I want to go and try the epistolary form. I want to see because the first thing I realized that people do as children is they write notes to each other with their most profound emotions in the second or third grade or whatever. Hey, do you think I'm cute? But they're usually little letters that they fold up in pretty little hearts and stuff and send them. So I decided to write a book of letters, just letters, in epistolary form. The long lines like Whitman, and just take it out like Emerson and those guys, you know, Thoreau. Just take all that stuff out, make it clean and crisp and clear. But do the letter thing, right? And then I thought, whoa, you know what I'll do next? I want to try the small, small poem, the two or three stanza poem with the three or four verse lines. I want to try that, and I want to try to keep it contained to the family, right? And then this book sells good, and this one people are don't like this one, and they're saying, well, why don't you go back to that one? And I'm like, nah, you know. So I change a lot. And then like the novel form, I could have easily gone in the narrative, the conventional narrative style, and just gone through it, which I'm doing in this new piece I'm working on, but in different ways. But this one, I decided to just throw all the different times around and play with everything else, you know.
Yeah.
And it kept me unbored.
Unbored.
Yeah, it kept me unbored. I was thinking.
He makes up words now.
It kept me. Yeah. By the way, when you learn the language in isolation, like I did, I would repeat myself, and I would have to use stuff like, a verb. I didn't know what a verb was. I was like, verb. Verb is action. It's an action. And then I would yell out in the cell block, Flaco! Orale, ¿qué tal, carnal? You're a verb. I say, you're a verb. What do you want? You trying to call me name? No, but you're in the book. You're very fast with a knife. You a verb. De veras, carnal, I'm in the book. Simón, bro, you're in the book. You're a verb. That's how I learned language. Gamboa, you know, adjective.
Okay, now. He tells me he's shy. Yeah? He writes that he's shy. You don't seem shy.
No. The point was, Carolyn, was I was walking with Denise Levertov one day, and I was talking, and she looked and she says, you're pronouncing all the words wrong. I said, really? She said, everything you say is wrong. So I sort of had to learn how to phonetically relearn the words. I knew what they meant. I just had the sound wrong. And so I had to relearn the sound.
But you're a great performer. Your reading is magnificent, you know. And you were an International Slam champion, right? How did that happen? How did you develop that?
I'm not a slam poet.
No, but you were a champion, weren't you?
I only did it because Peter Rabbit and Anne, God bless their souls, they're beautiful, beautiful. I love them. They're the best in the world. They came down 5 or 6 times to Black Mesa where I was living. And I've made my living as a writer for 31 years. And they came down several times and asked if I wanted to be a read. And I said, no, I got enough money to pay the bills. And then they came down one time and I didn't have enough money to pay the electric bill. So I said, sure, I'll go. So I went and I won. And Patti Smith got very, very upset when I won. She got really, really upset. And I told Patti Smith, no, you can keep the trophy, put your name on it, but the money goes home with Daddy.
Okay.
Otherwise that, or I sleep on the street.
So the performance came naturally to you.
Yeah, the poem, the language itself absorbs me to a point where I'm saturated by the language. And like when I read to you a while ago, there was no Jimmy Baca or anything like that. It was just the poems. And in fact, I'm not sure how you regulate reality, but if something were to happen where it disintegrated, I would be gone and the poem would still be standing on stage by itself. It's more real than I am. The poem is more real than I am, and thank God for that. Otherwise, I'd probably be dead. Yeah.
You avoided this the first time, but I'm going to go for it again a little bit. When I studied the Poets of Witness, of whom you are one, I noticed that they had certain things in common. The work, you know, sometimes they'd had the same images. They had blood, you'd expect blood. They had the body. They had roosters. They didn't like roosters so much. None of the poets from anywhere in the world ever wrote positively about a rooster in the 20th century. I noticed things like that, but other things as well. They would begin poems sometimes by asking forgiveness of the reader because they had to write the things they were writing. And they would try to reassure the reader. And they also experienced the past as unreal. They experienced their selves as somehow severed. Their past self and their present self were two different people. They talked to these two different people. They addressed death as if it were a person. They addressed war as if it were a person. The list is quite long that these things have in common. One thing I noticed in your work is a facility with this severing of selves or this multiplying of selves or an awareness of what Whitman said, you know, do I contradict myself? Fine, I contain multitudes. You seem to contain multitudes. And you write out of those different interrogations of self and identity. Is that something you're aware of or that you've worked on or worked toward or tried to give voice to?
Yes.
More. Jimmy, work with me here.
Let me just say this. I don't know how it happened, but my best work is yet to come. Let's just start with that. My best work is yet to come.
I think so.
And I'm just learning how to write. I'm really getting a real good idea on how to do things now. I'm really, really getting a very good idea about structure and form. And I'm learning story. I'm really getting a good thing going.
Can we correspond?
Yeah.
I'm really
good at it now. I know really what to do, and I know how to do it, and I know what's going on. But one of the things that saved me that you're talking about here is, and I think a lot of writers are like that, and thank God I fit into that camp. Good writers, good poets, is that I never collected anything. I don't want a car. You know, there's things I'm like a Spartan or an ascetic. I have all these papers on the desk, but really, really, there's only one little small poem I'm working on, right? And that has taught me to disembody myself. And literally, I have been planning my life in late November, early December, to go spend 6 months to study flowers. Wonderful. I want to go study flowers in northern New Mexico in a certain area, and I want to spend the entire winter in a cabin that I built studying flowers. This December. I want to go up there and get all the flowers. There's flowers that bloom in winter. I'm witness to that. I'm an evidence. I mean, my life has been the hardest, longest winter in my life, and yet I bloomed. Right? the blizzards came when I was born, and here I am. But the roosters and all of that. The redeeming factor in my life is that when I write, and I'm not saying this as a discipline of sorts or as a drudgery, I'm saying this as a redemptive grace, that if I get into the rooster, writing about roosters, I really do become a rooster. I mean, that's all I can tell you. When the day's done and I make salad for supper and put the wood in the stove, it's like it's been a long day of being a rooster, and I'm glad to be Jimmy sitting in front of the fire. I'm one of those people, and I thank God for that. I'm one of those people who can literally spend 4 hours trying to describe a rooster's tail feather in verse, 3 or 4 hours. And what the blessing and the grace that I have is that I truly enjoy it. It's not like something else I want to do. I don't want to go to their movie. I don't want to watch. I really dig this thing I'm doing.
I want to say something to you. I have a friend here tonight whose mother spent her whole life reading. She read everything. And when she was dying, she couldn't find anything she really wanted to read or could stay with or that she had the strength for, really. And my friend gave her your work. And she read it. She could read it. She wanted to read it. She read it as she was dying, and she told my friend, "That man has a heart."
Thank you.
So, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I got 2 kids in college. So, it's a funny thing you say that, because studying the flowers and studying the rooster's tail feathers is a way of acknowledging death. And once you do that as a poet or as a writer, your poetry suddenly just blooms, or your writing does. Something beautiful about the writing aspect that kills you. Something beautiful about writing that allows you to die during the writing process and also to be reborn again. So tell your friend, I said, thank you very, very much. That's a great thing that she said, and I try to work toward that, being in that place that she recognized. That's a good place.
It's the place you inhabit. Thank you, Jimmy, for
thank you
all
much.
Of this. It was wonderful.
Thank you. That was great.
Okay.
That was fantastic.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.